First Name Sports starts now.
We're kind of on a first name basis around here.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
Okay, let's get started.
From the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
What's going on, America? It's Wednesday afternoon on the Sports Map Radio Network. Hope everybody's enjoying. Can we still call it hump day?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, you'll allow it. I don't know, but see, Belmar, it's not like a traditional hump, you know, in the sense of, like, 2 days on the way up, boom, we're at the hump, 2 days on the way down.
It's still Wednesday, baby. All right. We can call it hump day.
Fine. And hey, shorter weeks we like, because maybe you still woke up today and thought it was Tuesday. I don't know if that lasts all week for everybody. I did for a second think it was Tuesday when I woke up today, but I said Wednesday. As we get started today, I felt it was appropriate to do some more kind of overarching, retrospective type of segments on the two teams in the NBA Finals on the eve of Game 1. We'll certainly dive a little deeper into the series breakdown in a little bit, but I think just chronicling the path that each of these two teams took and what we can learn from the paths in which they've taken and what we can take and how we should put into proper context what they have done is all something I felt would be appropriate for today's show before we get more into the nitty-gritty of the matchup. So let's start with, I think, what has been an all-time run by the Miami Heat. Because let's remember that only one team each year wins a championship in each sport. So that means that the other 29 teams or the other 31 teams, however many there are in the league, aren't going to be the champions. Now, unlike what Giannis Antetokounmpo said after the Bucks were eliminated by the Heat in the NBA playoffs, I don't believe that that means that your season is a failure if you are one of the teams that does not win the championship. There are underachievers. There are overachievers, all under the same umbrella of we didn't win the whole thing. And the thing that Giannis was running from when he said that was the fact that the Bucks were very much an underachiever. And they underachieved badly enough to where their season was undoubtedly a failure. So that's why I think that term was fair surrounding the Milwaukee Bucks. Now, on the other side of the coin, the Miami Heat have overachieved so much to where even if they get swept in these finals, this is a run that should be remembered for a while. No 8 seed under the best of 7 first round format has made the NBA Finals. The only other 8 seed to do it was the 1999 New York Knicks, who won a best of 5 first round, ironically enough, against the Miami Heat in 99. 3-2. You know, so again, I think that's relevant because in a first round series, if you're up 3-2 after 5, that doesn't mean you've closed it out. And you could very easily still lose. So the Heat are the first team in the best of 7 first round format as an 8 seed to go to the finals. And they have continued to defy the odds along the way. I mean, I think that clearly they were an underdog against Milwaukee. And they were a heavy underdog against Boston. And say what you want about the path that they took, the Heat are still here, and they still eliminated the top 2 seeds in the Eastern Conference. And when you look at the rise of a Caleb Martin And obviously what Jimmy Butler's been able to do. And all the pieces coming into place under the watch of Eric Spoelstra, who we can all agree is the better, is if not the best coach in the NBA, easily top three. And I just think it's important to still acknowledge that what they have accomplished is this is a March Madness-esque run from an NBA team. And think about all those Cinderellas that we talk about. Not a lot of them win the national championship. Shaka Smart didn't win the national championship at VCU in 2011. Loyola Chicago, more recently in 2018, didn't win the national championship. George Mason with Jim Larrañaga. We can go on and on. But we remember the moments that they gave us along the way. And that's exactly what the Miami Heat feel like now. 50-some point games from Jimmy Butler. I think it was game four against Milwaukee. He had 54. And again, Caleb Martin really just rock solid the entire Eastern Conference Finals. A lot of people felt he should have been the Eastern Conference Finals MVP. Eric Spoelstra now winning his sixth Eastern Conference championship as the head coach for the Miami Heat. Trying to get his third ring. There's a documentary tonight on NBA TV entitled Everything But the Chip, and it is commemorating the 2001 Philadelphia 76ers run. And as somebody that grew up in the Philly area, that's my favorite Sixers team ever. And I was 6 years old when it happened, so I was like kind of just starting to really remember sports. And that team, like everybody, when it was dress down day at school, because I went to a private Catholic school at the time and we would wear school uniforms, but everybody had an Allen Iverson jersey. And it was so much fun watching all the pieces come together. Larry Brown was the coach of the year. Dikembe Mutombo was the defensive player of the year. Aaron McKee was the sixth man of the year. And none of these guys were necessarily, other than Iverson, were highly thought of in NBA circles as, oh, we have to have Dikembe Mutombo or we have to have Aaron McKee. We have to have Eric Snow. But all the pieces fell into place and they went on this great run. And they ran into a monster that was the Lakers. And the Lakers hadn't lost a game in the playoffs until that first game against the Sixers in 2001, which is the single greatest game in Sixers history for people my age. And, yeah, the Lakers ended up winning the next four, and they were the better team. But to this day, you remember the moments that that team in 2001 gave all the fans. And I think certainly in Miami, even though they've won championships, this is a run that they should remember. And if you're just a fan of sports, this is one that we should remember, with how it's all come together and how close they were to being eliminated in the play-in tournament by the Chicago Bulls. And then they just keep winning and winning and winning, and they don't care about the outside noise or who people are picking. It's a group that just goes out and really plays a button-up brand where they don't get in their own way. They don't screw it up. And what that does is it allows you to take advantage of the other team screwing up. And I realize that you're still kind of banking on the door to be open, but the Heat always walk right through when that door's open, I'll tell you. And so, in other words, if you don't have your A game against the Heat, you can lose most nights because they tend to capitalize on the other team's screw-ups. And I think all of that is what makes that Heat culture so strong and has made this run that they've been on so memorable. You think back to, you know, when I talk about, oh, that door being slightly ajar. How about game two against Boston when Grant Williams stares down Jimmy Butler? At the time, I think it's a 10-point lead or whatever it was for Boston. Looked like they had the game taken care of. And Miami comes back and nabs it away. Different times over the course of the closeout game in Milwaukee, where they run that great out-of-bounds after-timeout play for Jimmy, which I can't remember if it sent the game to overtime or gave him a lead, but it was a big-time play down the stretch. They've had these different moments where they've just been able to kind of steal games away from the other teams. I mentioned the 54-point game four that Milwaukee or that Butler had against Milwaukee. So there have already been a lot of moments for Miami. And I just think it's important to still remember what has happened before we look ahead to what's going to happen starting tomorrow. Because a lot of people are going to pick Denver, and I understand why you would pick Denver. I've talked about it a lot during the Western Conference playoffs. It really feels like it is Denver's time. But I think being able to remember the fun ride that you have, and this isn't eulogizing the Miami Heat. Maybe they do win. And, of course, it makes the story that much better if the last chapter is one last upset in which, you know, then you're talking about a playoffs in which they knock out the number one seed in the East, the number one seed in the West, and the number two seed in the East. It's crazy. But I'm just saying, even if they don't do that, if you just watch sports because you're one of those people that says championship or bust every year, then you're going to be busted more often than not. You're not going to get a lot of championships. That's just the nature of sports. I mean, unless you're a Warriors fan the last decade, you know, or a Patriots fan, you have these select teams, Yankees, where it's just like all they do is win. But for the most part, you can't just expect championships. So you should still be able to get some joy out of some of the other things that happen along the way. And this Miami Heat season is a perfect example of that. I'll do a similar segment as to what we can take from the Nuggets to this point a little bit later on. But we got to hit the diamond. Major League Baseball is exactly one-third in the books with its regular season. We'll do some overachievers and underachievers thus far in each league. That's next. First Name Sports.
You're back with First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Live from the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Greg Frank.
Well, if the holiday weekend did not feel like the start of summer, if you're a sports fan, these last couple days sure feel like summer is at the very least here or right around the corner because, you know, baseball is the sport of the summer, and that's what we've had as we still await the NBA Finals beginning tomorrow night in the Mile High City. So we do have, obviously, just baseball taking us through most of the week. We do have an NBA Finals game tomorrow and then nothing on Friday in either of the championship rounds in the NBA and the NHL Stanley Cup Final beginning on Saturday night. So anyway, it felt like a good time. And I actually said this on Friday in our Friday Five. Memorial Day has always been the bar for me where I say, okay, we've played about a third of the season. What do we have? And so in advance of having Scott Miller on in the next segment, I wanted to share some observations from the Major League Baseball season thus far. I got three overachievers and three underachievers in each league. And we'll start with the American League overachievers. And even though I think it's a little bit of a cop-out, I have to put the Rays as an overachiever because they are still, despite, you know, they finally come back to earth a little bit in the sense that they're only on pace now to win 111 games. The record is 116 set by the Seattle Mariners in 2001. But this would be, like, if they even get close to this 116, this would be the best of all the things that they've done, because I think a lot of people like to bring up, as frugal and as, you know, nifty as the Rays are in putting their team together, they have not won the World Series. And so while I think some people would say, well, they can't be the model for how to build if they haven't won. Now, I think that's fair, but I also think that they have done a lot of things that other teams have emulated, as evidenced by the fact that there are coaches, managers, executives that had worked for the Rays that are hired elsewhere in Major League Baseball quite a bit. So if they, and yet, despite all that, they're still on pace to win 111 games. So I think clearly the Rays have to still be like labeled. You probably had them as a playoff team, but I don't know that you had them flirting with the record, which I, you know, that'll be something to watch all summer is what's their pace like, and are they going to maybe flirt with 116 wins? So the Rays are my first overachiever. Feels a little obvious, as I said, maybe a bit of a cop-out, but you have to put them on there. The next team that's overachieving is in this division. That's the Baltimore Orioles, who are only three games behind the Rays in the AL East. And I think what's really impressive about this is the fact that we know in this division that it's always going to be competitive because the Yankees are the Yankees. The Blue Jays have obviously been very competitive in recent seasons. And I keep waiting for another year in which the Red Sox, become the Red Sox again. Because if you look at the Red Sox the last 20 years, they won the World Series in 04, then they won again in 07, then they won in 13, and then they won in 18. And in between those World Championship years, there were some dips that the Red Sox took, but then they got back and won again. And 18 is the most recent championship, so it feels like we're due for the Red Sox to have a competitive season again. And everyone in the American League East is over 500, but it's the Orioles that are the biggest threat right now to the Tampa Bay Rays. They're playing really well away from home, too. How about 18-9 thus far on the road for the Baltimore Orioles? And I always have said, hey, if my team can play 5 to 10 games over 500 on the road and then 15 or so games over 500 at home, I got a team that's going to win 90, 95 games. I'm in the playoffs. And everything beyond that, and we'll certainly get to this with the National League, is about peaking at the right time, pushing the right buttons with the managerial decisions late in playoff games. Things become a lot more micro in the playoffs as opposed to macro in the regular season. So I just want to get there. And so if I have an Orioles team that's 9 over 500 2 months into the season on the road, that's pretty impressive. And they're only 6 over 500 at home. So you figure their home record will improve. And I think more than anything, it's just the fact that a lot of their players have arrived to the big league level now. The Orioles were, you know, the recent example of a team that just sat at the bottom, stockpiled prospects. And if they stockpile the correct prospects, graduate them to the big leagues, they're good. It obviously worked for the Astros, worked for the Cubs, as examples that won the World Series that way. You could even argue the Kansas City Royals were kind of like that in assembling their core that won in 2015. And now the Orioles seem to be on that upward trajectory. So undoubtedly, Baltimore an overachiever. And then my third overachiever in the American League is the Texas Rangers, who are only one behind Tampa in the loss column for the best record in baseball. Texas is scoring a ton of runs. Their pitching is holding up without Jacob DeGrom healthy. Major League Baseball, when they moved the Astros to the American League, was probably praying for a Texas rivalry here with the Astros and Rangers. And we might finally have it this year after, for the better part of the last decade, when we've had those two teams in the American League West. It started off, the Rangers were pretty good and the Astros were rebuilding. Then when the Astros started to get good, the Rangers went down. There was maybe a year or two of an overlap there. And now the Rangers, a lot of that money they spent, looking to be money well spent so far. So the Rangers undoubtedly look like they may be the biggest overachiever in baseball so far, but certainly in the American League. Some National League overachievers. And again, this is a little bit more subjective because I don't think anybody in the National League jumps out and say, wow, they've overachieved. The best records in the National League are the Atlanta Braves and the Los Angeles Dodgers, but Atlanta's 9 over 500, and by the way, just lost back-to-back games to the Oakland A's, and the Dodgers are 12 over 500, and you look up and say, that sounds about right for where the Dodgers would be this time of year. It's not like they're on this historic pace like the Rays might be on or things like that. So I think you have to try and, nitpick a little bit more to find your National League overachievers. I went with the Pittsburgh Pirates as my first one. They've cooled off a little bit after a really good start, but still, we're sitting here 54 games in, which is exactly one-third of 162, and the Pittsburgh Pirates are 27-27. And I think that relative to expectations, if the Pirates were going to be 500 this 2 months in, you would have said, oh, that's not bad. You know, that's a team that has been at the bottom, stockpiling prospects, wasn't sure when that they would start to compete, but didn't think it would be this year. And 500 is a sign of progress. So I think the Pirates, certainly an overachiever so far through 2 months. Another team that I think we should take more seriously than just, oh, they're cute, maybe they'll be 500, the Arizona Diamondbacks. They sit just a game and a half behind the Los Angeles Dodgers in the National League West. This is undoubtedly one of the bigger overachievers in baseball. Their young core is coming together. Corbin Carroll looks like a National League Rookie of the Year candidate. Geraldo Perdomo, another young player in their lineup that looks like a nice young bat. Zach Gallen flirting with the National League Cy Young, perhaps. So the Diamondbacks, it looked like they were coming. And that they were getting closer and a little bit overshadowed by the Dodgers and even the Giants in 2021 had a big year, and the Padres in that division. Diamondbacks, absolutely an overachiever. And then I went with the Marlins as my third one, although it looks like their run differential indicates at minus 46 that they are a very easy regression candidate, perhaps in the middle third of the year. But they are ahead of the Mets and the Phillies in the National League East in a division we all thought would be wildly competitive. The Marlins so far treading water, to say the least. Underachievers in the American League. I'm going to start with the Cleveland Guardians. This is a team that I've admired because they don't spend a ton of money. They're kind of like the Rays of the American League Central. They move off of Francisco Lindor, Trevor Bauer, and yet they still turn out good teams mostly. Six games under 500, and this is the defending American League Central champion, a team that had the Yankees in a Game 5 in the American League Division Series last year. Not a great start for the Cleveland Guardians at 6 under 500. I'm going to stay in the American League Central and go with the Chicago White Sox as my next underachiever. Thought maybe it was just Tony La Russa, but they were 500 last year. They're 11 below 500 2 months in. And then the Seattle Mariners. I mean, we looked at them as, oh, if it's not Houston, maybe Seattle could finally, you know, threaten the Astros. And instead, we're talking about Tampa, Baltimore, and Texas as the threats to the Houston Astros in the American League. Quickly, the underachievers in the National League, both teams from the NLCS last year, the Padres and the Phillies, have been struggling. The Padres, obviously, with all the money they've spent, it just has not manifested itself into anything of value right now. The Padres are 4 below .500, an identical record the Phillies have. They've had all kinds of pitching problems, and they have not gotten a lot of timely hitting. And then the Cardinals, another team that made the playoffs last year, last place are the Cardinals. Baseball Town USA, I guess, is what they call it that in St. Louis. But it's been ugly thus far for the Redbirds. We'll take a timeout. We'll do some more baseball with Scott Miller, Major League Baseball SiriusXM contributor, New York Times contributor. He's our guest on the other side. First Name Sports, Sports Map Radio.
With First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Live from the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Greg Frank.
All right, a lot of baseball in the first hour of the show today as we go out to the Progressive Guest Line and bring on Scott Miller, baseball contributor for the New York Times, SiriusXM, MLB Radio, joining us right now. Scott, good to have you aboard. How are you?
Hey, nice to be with you, Brad. How are you?
Absolutely, doing pretty well as we get started. And I wanted to just ask you about Aaron Judge, who is on a pace that's identical to last year, and I think we all felt, well, this is a historic season. We're never going to see this again. Through May 30th, 2022, he had 18 homers. Last night was May 30th, 2023, 18 homers. What can you say about the start to the year for Aaron Judge?
Well, you can argue it's even a better start than last year because Judge missed 11 games earlier this year with an injury. Last year, he was on the field the whole time. So, you know, he's doing what he did last year in fewer games.
Yeah.
It just leaves you shaking your head. And what he's doing is remarkable. And not only offensively, but defensively. You know, he's really good in the field. The other night, in Monday night, the series opener in Seattle, he had two home runs. And they went up over the fence to rob Jared Kelnick of a home run. I mean, the ball clearly would have gone over the right field fence, but for Judge, who, you know, he's got a little bit of an advantage out there. He's 6'7", but, you know, then again, you always hear, well, yeah, but those big tall guys can't really move and they struggle sometimes. I mean, he's an athlete. He can move. He's robbing opposing hitters of home runs. He's doing what he did last year in fewer games. It's shaping up to be another season to watch for Aaron Judge because he's remarkable.
Well, Shohei Ohtani's also pretty remarkable, and he hit his 13th home run of the season last night, a 435-foot moonshot on the south side of Chicago. Just another year, it feels like, for him. Is he won the MVP 2 years ago, was the MVP runner-up last year, and figures to be right in the mix again, right?
Yeah, he does. On the mound, he hasn't been quite as good the last four or five outings as normal, but that's still high praise because he's still doing stuff nobody else is doing. I mean, you know, he's still really good on the mound and a presence on the mound. And if he hadn't been quite as good, it's a case of the expectations for him. He set the bar so high that you expect him to be, you know, just dominant every single time out. And yeah, as far as the MVP, I mean, you know, it's funny. I heard a couple of the Yankees broadcasters on the telecast the other night, you know, already lobbying for Aaron Judge. And, I mean, I don't blame him. Judge is, like we talked about, he's fantastic. But you could almost create a separate category award for Ohtani. I mean, theoretically, if he keeps producing, yeah. I mean, you could make a case for him to win the MVP every single year because, again, no other player is playing two ways as he is and contributing the way he is in so many different areas.
We're still about 2 months away from the trade deadline, but do you have any inclination as to how 2023 finishes up for him?
For Ohtani, I don't think they're going to trade him by the deadline. I really don't.
Wow.
I mean, you can argue from a business sense they should because if they lose, you know, if they're not going to re-sign him, obviously, he's a free agent this year, and the Angels, it would be catastrophic for that organization if they just lose Shohei Ohtani for nothing and get nothing in return. So that's where the impetus, of course, is to trade him. But they're kind of a tough spot. I mean, they're 29-27. They're third place. They're 7 games behind Texas. I think if they take an honest look in the mirror, the Angels, they're going to have to take that look in the mirror and decide we're not a legitimate contender. Now, they may be able to sneak into the expanded playoffs in one of the wild card slots.
Sure.
But, you know, I mean, are they as good as Tampa Bay? No. Are they as good as Baltimore? No. Yankees? No. Are they as good as Texas or Houston? No. I don't see them delivering the winner Ohtani wants this year, which makes me think he will leave them this winter. But the tricky thing, too, as far as the trade deadline, like I said, I think it'd be catastrophic if he just signs with somebody else's free agent and they just don't get a thing. The one argument against trading him for the deadline, aside from if they think they can contend, which if they do, I think they're, you know, kind of in dreamland, but you know, he does represent a significant amount of business. I mean, their corporate advertising. I mean, the Angels are making a lot of money from Japan, you know, because of Ohtani. And if they trade him, you know, what happens to those deals? Are they going to peter out early? I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but I do know every game is telecast in Japan. Mm. And not only when I said it would be catastrophic for the Angels to lose him for nothing, that's on the field from a competitive standpoint. But also, I mean, you know, the Angels brand name in Japan with Ohtani is pretty good. And if all of a sudden he leaves, you know, the Angels are going to take a hit on the business side too.
Okay, let's stay in the American League West and go to the bottom of the division. And at the bottom of the sport right now is the Oakland A's. Just your thoughts on that situation. You know, I think it's sad, but it does feel like, you know, things are at least moving forward in Vegas. Kind of how do you see things moving forward with the A's?
Yeah, it is sad. They have a rich history in Oakland. And I think, you know, it's too bad. They've been trying to get a new stadium for years. And the problem is, I mean, how the sport of baseball, the other owners have allowed it to get to this situation to where John Fisher, the owner of the A's, has completely torpedoed the team. I mean, he's finally reached a point where, you know, the only way to get a new stadium is if I just make our team so bad that almost like he's looking for the sympathy vote. Like people are looking, and like he tried to make them so god awful that others will look and say, "Oh, geez, this is so pathetic. We better get you a stadium." And I mean that's how low it's sunk. And for baseball to allow, I mean, the integrity of the game is the competition, right? And we don't have that with Oakland. I mean, every night they take the field with this roster, it's a blight on the integrity of the game. So you would have thought something could have gotten figured out before it got this bad. But where we're at now, it is this bad. Obviously, it looks like they're headed to Las Vegas. Although I will say, given the soap opera that this has been over really the last 15 years, until they actually take the field in Las Vegas as the Las Vegas Athletics,
yeah,
I'm going to just continue to hold my breath because it still could turn back to Oakland.
You know, I want to stay out west and ask you about an underachiever that sure spent a bunch of money, and that's the San Diego Padres. Why do you think they haven't taken off the way I'm sure people thought they would, especially after making the National League Championship Series last year? And is there room for them to turn it around here?
Yeah, I mean, there's room for them to turn it around. They're 25-29, 8 games behind the Dodgers. If you think back to the 2019 season, the Washington Nationals, I believe they were 21-29 in their first 40 games, which isn't that far off from where the Padres are now. Padres 25-29. I think the Nationals were 21-29, and they obviously in 2019, they ended up fixing their bullpen, which was the problem, coming back, figuring things out. They won the World Series. So there's still a long way to go. The Padres absolutely can turn it around. Now, will they? But the first thing they're going to have to do, and this is one big reason they're in the predicament they're in, they have the worst batting average in the game with runners in scoring position. These guys cannot hit when they get runners in scoring position. I think part of it is the Juan Sotos and, before he got hurt, the Manny Machados, the Xander Bogarts. You know, they're all trying to take it upon themselves and make sure they're the ones that drive in runs. And I think it's just, you know, you can tell they're hitting too much pressure, or they're putting too much pressure on themselves, trying to do too much. I think they've got to step back and let the game come to them a little bit. That's one thing. Secondly, it's a really top-heavy lineup. Those names I mentioned, plus Fernando Tatis Jr., they've got some, you know, complete A-list marquee all-stars. But then you get to the bottom third of their lineup, and it's just a black hole, and that's part of the issue too. And they're not pitching quite as well. I think the pitching will come around, and it has started to come around. Joe Musgrove broke his toe in spring training; he dropped a weight on it, so he didn't start the season until toward the end of April. Yu Darvish didn't pitch much in the World Baseball Classic. He played for Team Japan, but he didn't get as much work as the Padres thought he was going to get. So he had kind of a slow start to the season. So there's a lot of different things going on with the Padres. And, you know, where they're at now, they've dug a huge hole for themselves. Sure. They can get out of it, but I don't want to act like it's going to be easy. They've got a lot of work to do.
There he is, Scott Miller, SiriusXM MLB Radio, New York Times contributor. Scott, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Take care, Brett.
First Name Sports with Greg Frank continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right, I want to go back to the hardwood. Greg Frank, by the way, that's my name, in case you didn't know. I like Scott, but I don't know where that came from. Brett. Whatever. Let's go back to the hardwood. Talked a little bit about how I think it's important to, before the finals begin, acknowledge and appreciate what the Miami Heat have done thus far. I think there's a little something we can learn from the Denver Nuggets as well as they continue on this run. And, you know, I'm probably going to pick the Nuggets to win this series. But what is it that we can learn from what they've done so far. And the short answer is this. Do not abandon your cores right away if you are not getting immediate results. Okay, now I know it's easy to say, well, of course they were going to stay patient. Jamal Murray got hurt. But they kept the core together. That core has grown up. They've added to it with some different role players. And guys started making big plays in big moments. Jamal Murray wasn't the same Jamal Murray before he tore his ACL. He's a better player now. Nikola Jokic is probably the best player in the NBA right now. So the message here is, again, do not abandon your cores too early just because the results aren't immediate. I think that's one thing that is true with almost every superstar in the NBA. We put expectations saddled upon them when they come into the league or when they rise to stardom. And if they don't reach those expectations sooner rather than later, we run out of patience. And, you know, I'll even use the guy that's about to go number one overall, Victor Wembanyama. Should we expect Victor Wembanyama to win a championship within his first 5 years with the Spurs? I mean, if that's what you're thinking, it's probably not going to happen. And Victor Wembanyama could be everything that he's hyped up to be. But he might not have a championship, say, even by the end of the decade. And that might not even be his fault. LeBron James didn't win his first championship until 2012. He came into the league in 2003. So you have to have, and we'll get to this a little bit later on when we talk about the Warriors and their ownership bracing for change amidst the resignation of Bob Myers. But you have to be able to find the star players to begin with, surround them accordingly, have the right coach that's going to be able to push the right buttons in big playoff games. All of the puzzle pieces have to come together. And so while basketball can be very individualized, and it's very much about getting those top-end players, those stars, because if you don't have them, you don't have a chance, that doesn't mean once you have them, you're automatically destined for greatness. And I go back to pre-ACL injury Jamal Murray when he was with the Nuggets. Yeah, they made the conference finals in the bubble in 2020, and they got clobbered by the Lakers, excuse me. So this is kind of my point about how that team in the bubble in 2020 loses in five, and then 3 years later, after Murray tears his ACL, he's back with the Nuggets, engineering them along with Jokic to a sweep of the same Lakers team. So that's almost an exact 180. They were, you know, gentlemen swept in 2020 by the Lakers, sweeping the Lakers in 2023, and the roster doesn't look that much different from 2020 to 2023 for Denver. Go even back to 2019, who Denver lose to? The Portland Trailblazers in seven games, in which they lost a game seven at home to Portland. So this was a Nuggets team that made one conference finals prior to this year and lost in five in that conference finals. And we don't say they need to blow it up. We don't say they need to, you know, we weren't saying they needed to move on from Nikola Jokic or, yeah, they just had to wait for Jamal Murray to get healthy. And honestly, even if Murray never tore his ACL, if they didn't get to the NBA finals or even the conference finals the last couple of years, I wouldn't be saying it's time to blow it up either because, again, Jamal Murray was drafted in 2016. Nikola Jokic was drafted in 2014. So these are guys that are in their late 20s, early 30s just now, which is around the time when you can start to expect them to win a title. And here we are in 2023. The Nuggets are the favorite in the NBA Finals over the Miami Heat. So as it pertains to the rest of the NBA, no, the Boston Celtics should not be breaking up Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. Because I touched on this a little bit yesterday. They went to 4 conference finals with these guys and 1 NBA finals. So, yes, Jaylen Brown was atrocious on Monday night in Game 7. And Jason Tatum has had some playoff doldrums of his own. But that's all part of the growing pains that most superstars go through. And eventually it will be, you know, at least I believe you have to adopt the mindset of eventually it will be their time. And we're going to bet on these guys to keep growing up, which is what I would do if I was Boston. Okay. And yes, people are going to say, well, Jaylen Brown eligible for that Supermax now because he made an all-NBA team. Do you want to give him $50 million a year? I think you're better with Jaylen Brown than you are without Jaylen Brown. Plain and simple. And so if you trade him, whatever you end up getting, you're hoping one of those young players in a package, you know, whether, you know, people are talking about maybe Portland with the 3rd pick, you know, and if there's somebody that the Celtics like at the top of the draft, or maybe Houston, Jalen Green. You're hoping that Jalen Green or, you know, whoever else, whatever other young, maybe the 4th pick in the draft that Houston has, you're hoping that one of these young guys that you get becomes Jaylen Brown, as opposed to just having Jaylen Brown, which is a damn good place to start. So, yes, your roster might suffer a little bit in terms of your depth, and that's where the Boston Celtics need to be a little frugal, right? And they need to be able to find – they've been able to do it. You know, Derek White, you draft Grant Williams in the late of the 1st round. Different guys like that. Maybe Peyton Pritchard becomes a bigger part of the rotation. Whoever it is, like that, that's where if you're going to lose some players elsewhere, you need to be able to fill out your core around Tatum and Brown when they're making more money. Like, that's just the nature of the NBA. But what's also the nature of the NBA is I need those stars if I want to have a chance to win a championship. So even if they're taking up a larger portion of the salary cap, I'd rather have them than not have them. It's the same reason why I thought it was crazy that people were suggesting the Sixers trade Joel Embiid. Because then you move off of him, and you're either completely rebuilding already, or you're getting a collection of players who all of them seem to be decent. Like, you're getting maybe 3 or 4 rotation players for him, and a couple of maybe 1 or 2 all-stars in the package. But all right, none of them are Joel Embiid, and then so you've lessened your ceiling as far as I'm concerned because you don't have that top-end player. You don't have that MVP caliber player, which is what you need in the NBA. And again, I think the Nuggets are an example of stay patient, stay the course, be confident, bet on your own guys as opposed to betting on other guys who you can get in trades. Bet on your own guys to figure it out, to get better as they age, to develop accordingly to where they want to make big plays in big games. And yeah, it stinks that sometimes you have to watch a Game 7 like Embiid had against Boston or a Game 7 like Jaylen Brown had against Miami where he turns the ball over a bunch. But I would sooner bet on my guys to figure it out than I would bet on other guys to replace the guys that I have who I already know are immensely talented. And Denver did that. Denver stayed the course, and I understand that Murray was injured, but there was still a level of patience that the Nuggets had to exhibit these last few years. As I said, even before Murray got hurt, the Lakers clobbered them in the Western Conference Final in the bubble, and Portland beat them on their home floor in a Game 7 in the 2nd round. And the Nuggets, here they are now. It feels like it's their time. So if you keep knocking on that door, Boston Celtics, Sixers, all these other teams that, you know, come up short. The Sixers obviously have not had any kind of degree of playoff success that Boston has with Brown and Tatum. But those are just examples. Dallas with Luka Doncic, right? Like, it got to a Western Conference Finals last year. Yeah, it was a disappointing year this year. But you got to keep trying when you have those top-end players on the roster because that's what you need to even get a foot in the door when it comes to contention in the association. We'll take a timeout and we'll come back. When do you dive in on a big-time TV show? This in light of the conclusion of Succession over the holiday weekend. Dive into that next. Halfway home on a Wednesday. First Name Sports, Sports Map Radio.